Welcome to The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. Here's your host, Jeff Nadeau.
What's up, everybody, and welcome into another edition of The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Nadeau. Hope you're having a great day and an even better evening. We are back and better than ever. Another week, another sit down, another great episode planned for you today. Let me bring in my co-host, Blackjack Fletcher. Blackjack, how you doing? Another great episode last week on Tony Spilotro. We head back to New York this week. How you doing? How's your week going, man?
I'm doing great, brother. You know, we had a good Super Bowl on Sunday, a very good game. We wound up making a bunch of money off of that, so happy about that. And now we're digging back into the New York roots in the show with a guy who's made some headlines more recently than some of the people we've talked about a lot.
Yeah, you know, week to week, I've always said I'm very excited to do this show, but I'm actually really excited for this show today. I've always found today's subject to be incredibly interesting. I think he really melds together not only the old school mob, particularly the Bonanno crime family, but he had a lot of interesting connections to people like Jimmy Burke, the Goodfellas. And I think he also really is a big problem. Like when we look at the film Donnie Brasco, we are led to believe that in that film, Lefty Ruggiero was always penny pinching, right? He was not earning, not making any money. The truth of the matter was in our subject, Vinny Asaro's life, who we're talking about today, one of the reasons that he would get jammed up really just a couple of years ago was his inability to make money. He was at a point, and this would really go to show you what the mob is today. He was at a point in the 2010s where money wasn't coming in. And what happened, Blackjack, is he started, and this is one of the mob's problems now, is they start doing business with anyone who can earn them money. There's no credit check. There's no background look. If you can make money, they'll do business with you. And that would lead to big problems for Vincent Asaro. And we'll get into that in just a second, a very colorful life. But I felt like it was a good topic to have for the second half hour of the show. And I know there'll be one or two or maybe five people that don't like the Q&A. Obviously, you can fast forward to it, but there are a lot of people that enjoy the Q&A and got some great questions. We don't do them much. I thought it'd be a good week to do one. So, Blackjack, what do you say we get into the Q&A? Before we do that, I do want to let everybody know, go follow us on Twitter at the Sit Down 7. You can get updates on the show. You can talk to me and kind of get anything you want out there. You can also, see some great mob facts as always. And I do urge everyone to also go check out the Sit Down on YouTube. I continue to build the YouTube channel. We're getting closer to 6,000 subscribers on YouTube. So please go check that out. I do some interviews occasionally on there and really kind of have as a subset of the show. Blackjack, how was the Super Bowl for you? I actually did pretty well in the game.
Me too. Yeah, I had the majority of my money on the Rams money line, so that worked out. I hit a couple of props that were nice ones, and it was a good game. So I no complaints on my end.
Yeah, hopefully all of you, the listeners out there, if you embarked on some bets in the game, hopefully you had some success. All right, let's get into the Q&A. We'll start with Jersey Girl, very nice lady. She's a fan of the show. She has a pretty obscure question, and I know a little bit about this individual. I don't know how much you know, Blackjack. She says she's a Jersey girl, and she has a Jersey question, and it has to do with the Real Housewives of New Jersey. There's a woman on that show called Carolyn Manzo. She asks, what are your thoughts on Tiny Manzo's death? Now, Tiny Manzo is the father of her husband, and he was actually murdered, her father-in-law, about a year before she would marry her now husband, Albert. His father was a mob enforcer in New Jersey, and they called him Tiny Manzo, even though he wasn't tiny. He was about 400 pounds, Blackjack, big guy. She asks, what are your thoughts on it? Well, look, it was a death that was obviously very interesting. If you know anything about it, Tiny Manzo had a beef with an individual called Joe Zara. Joe Zara was a soldier, and they had kind of a back and forth beef. And, you know, Zara was one of those guys. He actually kind of behaved in the way I do. I don't like when people are constantly needling me, fucking with me, annoying me, trying to talk shit to me. And I guess Tiny Manzo kept doing that, kept needling him. He wouldn't stop. And eventually Zara got sick of it and clipped him. His body was found in the parking lot of a shopping center in Hillside, New Jersey. What do I think about it? I'm not surprised by it. It's obvious if you've watched, whether it's Mob Wives or Real Housewives or any of these shows, there are some mob connections. As far as Manzo, you know, I don't know a whole lot about him, but it seemed like he was kind of a prick. And that's kind of all I think about it. But, you know, Blackjack, these shows on TV, there's a lot more mob connections than we think.
Yeah, for sure. And Tiny Manzo actually has an interesting kind of footnote to his life. His widow actually had a court case that wound up going all the way to the Supreme Court in New Jersey about collecting on his life insurance policy. When they found him dead, she tried to collect on $500,000 policy, and they denied it because he lied about having diabetes on the application. And the Supreme Court in New Jersey ruled in favor of the life insurance company and said that if you lie on a life insurance application, no matter, even if it has nothing to do with the cause of death, it still nullifies the policy.
Yeah, as I said, I mean, he was a pretty big guy, and that's why you don't lie on life insurance policies, because they're generally going to find out.
Yep.
But yes, yeah, very interesting subset story. Michael Yeady, what mafia member would you like to see a movie about? We've talked about this. I think I said Chin Gigante, I believe. I don't remember, but yeah, I think Joey Messina would be interesting, obviously. I'm trying to think who else. I mean, you know, the Philly crew, maybe a film from when Bruno gets whacked all the way until present day. I do think there's a lot of meat on the bone still with mob stories. I know there's a lot of things in the works. I know there's a Greg Scarpa thing in the works. I know the Mafia Cops, that's in the works. There's all sorts of things, but there's still a lot of things, Blackjack, in the mob culture that, you know, are very popular that we haven't touched. And we've kind of had our fair share of Sammy Gravano and John Gotti and people like that. But all in all, there's still a lot of untouched mob stories that I think would be great on the big screen.
I mean, the Gigante one is a layup. It amazes me no one's made that movie, because there's just so much that could be done there. I also would like to see a really thorough movie done on Carlo Gambino. I think there's a lot of meat on that bone, too, that we haven't gotten involved in. And I'd like to see someone do that.
I guess the next mob film that will come out will be the Gotti film, you know, we need yet another Gotti film. I don't know if we do, but we'll definitely be getting it. But yeah, I think there's still some out there that I'd like to see. Chin Gigante would probably be at the top of my list. All right. Luke, I'm interested in the mobster daily and weekly routine. Is it 24/7? Do you have a routine? Is there more work or play? Well, I don't think there's a routine. Obviously, most have collections that I have to do. Most of them have regular jobs at the end of the day. Like, they may have a company they work for. So, for instance, like, I always related to, like, someone like John Stanfa, who was a Philly boss. He actually had a food distribution company. Obviously, he was sitting in his office and stuff, but you know, he obviously had people below him. He had a company he was dealing with. And then he had, you know, ancillary pieces that were handling the day-to-day operations in the streets. As far as like a soldier, what do they do every day? I would have to imagine they're out there finding ways to earn, whether it's collecting, going to, a wire room if you're a bookmaker, or, you know, getting with your people that, you know, to get loan sharking stuff dealt with. As far as, is it a lot of play? Look, I think a lot of it is just very monotonous and regular. I don't think, other than being like bosses and some of the higher echelon people, it's just like any other life. Is there play involved? Sure. I think a lot of the younger guys, maybe ones that aren't married, you know, they're still going out to clubs and things like that. But a lot of these are just knock around people. They have families, they have wives. I don't think it's that sexy of a life. Obviously, it's a much tougher life than most, because they have to deal with the constant scrutiny from the government and, you know, for people that don't like them. So is it a daily and weekly routine? Look, John Gotti, I'm sure, had a daily routine. You know, he probably went to the Bergen, and then he went into the Ravenite, and then he, you know, would have a dinner at home. You know, they all lived like pretty similar lives. I don't think any of these people, Blackjack, outside of maybe in history, maybe 5 or 10, lived in like mansions and like were out traveling all the time. It didn't really work like that.
No, and I think it's definitely more work than play. I think sometimes the movies highlight on the, you know, they glorify the leisure aspects of it and the perks, but I think it's definitely a lot of work. And I think it's more of a lifestyle than a routine. I think it just becomes, you know, it's a different lifestyle than working a 9-to-5 job. So I think that's kind of what you fall into. But yeah, I think it's certainly a lot of work.
All right. Debo McElroy, can you speak to Angel Gotti's lawsuit? Okay. So look, if you know me, there's no secret. There's no love lost between Angel and I. She doesn't like me. I have no issue with her. As far as her lawsuit, did you see this box track?
Yeah.
Okay. So basically, for anyone that doesn't know, Angel Gotti has sued, Angel and her son has sued Gene Borello. Gene's a former mob, associate who's involved with the Bonanno family. And we're actually going to talk a little bit about Gene today in today's show. He is being sued by Angel and her son over salacious posts on Instagram and other social networks where he basically created some fake Instagram accounts and started harassing her, putting her face on bodies, things like that. Really kind of lowbrow, immature shit, I got to be honest. Can I speak through a lawsuit? Look, I'm not a lawyer. I don't know a whole lot about it. Look, she's all within her right, though. I think people just assume that because they're on the internet, and I've dealt with this in my own personal life, people think they can say whatever the hell it is they want. And the truth of the matter is, when you start to disparage people, there's a certain level of thing that you just can't say. And I don't know the crux of the entire lawsuit. I know the people involved. I know, I've spoke to Gene before. I know Lee Cole, who Gene hypothetically told this stuff to. I've told Lee I didn't understand his behavior in recording the phone calls. But this is a big soap opera, Blackjack. There's a subset of mob genre on YouTube that is very childish. And, I think Angel's far within her rights to do what she has to do. Look, I have, she has her own opinions about me. All I try to do is tell the truth, and I try to have a good show, and she does her own thing as well. She's far within her rights. What did you think of hearing about this?
I think that she's got really solid grounds, if we're being honest. I mean, it's one thing to go out and make accusations, about people. It's another thing to superimpose their faces on sex videos, which he did. It's another thing to post fake photos on the internet of people allegedly doing drugs. You know, when you start doing stuff like that, like especially the porn stuff, you get into revenge porn statutes and things like that. Like, it's not good. I mean, it goes beyond, your freedom of speech is limited by slander laws. And I think that Borello has certainly crossed that line with a few of these things. Like, you can sit there and call her and her whole family rats, and no one's going to be able to do anything. But when you start, putting people's heads on porn videos and superimposing faces on people injecting drugs, you're crossing a line.
Yeah, 100%. And look, this is some of the behavior that Gene has definitely been involved in. I mean, Gene's fighting some cases right now, on the internet. Some of the things that he did with his ex-girlfriend and the husband. I mean, just some of his behavior is out of control. And, look, Gene's got to start, wising up, because he's still on paper. Obviously going to have some problems with this. We'll see what ends up happening. We'll have to keep a lookout. But, again, when we look at someone like Gene Borello, these are the kind of people that Vincent Asaro was dealing with late in his life. And we'll talk about that. You can call someone fat, you can call them ugly, you can call them a rat. But when you start, insinuating that people use heroin and saying, infecting business that they have and things of that nature, that's where it becomes more slanderous and defaming and that sort of thing. Some mobsters made serious money, yet were never conspicuous with it. Where did all of the money go? I think a lot of the money, when we're talking about like high level people, so let's say Carlo Gambino or Vince Gigante, I think it just went to their families. I mean, those people are living, really well. You look at the Gambino family, most of those guys are never going to have to work again. I know the Gigantes do very well. I'm sure Tony Salerno, his family is doing just fine. Look at, all due respect, look at the Gottis. I mean, you ever see John Gotti's home, Jr.? He seems like he's doing okay. We have to remember, guys, that most of the money these people make, is it illegitimate? Sure. But it's the government's burden to prove that it was either good or not good money. And a lot of the money that someone like Junior Gotti made, the government's been unable to prove otherwise that it was from ill-gotten gains. So they also remember, it's not just you know, Junior got convicted, but he was only convicted of some of the more lesser charges. He was never truly convicted of a lot of this stuff. So, you know, they can't just seize money. They have to prove, as you know, Blackjack, that the money was gotten from ill-gotten gains, and they couldn't do that in his case or some of the others.
Yeah, and I think you hit the nail on the head with regard to the question that I think a lot of it just goes to their families. I mean, you know, that's kind of the point of doing this, right? Is you know, most of these guys know that you can't go and live an extravagant lifestyle and flaunt it in the government's face. What you're doing is setting up your family, hopefully, for a few generations so that they will have the money that you've earned. So I think that's where most of the money goes.
Exactly. Darren Summers, can you get copies of Real FBI Wiretaps and The Mob? And if so, where can I listen to them? Thanks, guys. Love the show and YouTube channel. All right. Couple things here. Do I know if there's a place you can get any wiretap ever? No, that's not something or anything that I have access to. However, there's a lot of wiretaps online. I mean, you can listen to wiretaps from anyone from Tony Corallo to Paul Castellano to Lefty Ruggiero to John Gotti to Kabani Savage. I mean, you can listen to most of that stuff online. There's also some great books. Wiretap is a great book by James Good. It's one of my favorite mob books. Also, The Gotti Tapes. There's all sorts of wiretap alike books, but you know, most of those things you can find right online.
Yeah, any tape that's been played in open court is available to you through the Freedom of Information Act through the FBI. So if you're willing to take the time to fill out the paperwork, you can get a copy of any tape that's been played in open court through the Freedom of Information Act website.
John Jackson, were the Westies subordinates to the Gambino family or the mob in general, or were they seen as equals not to be messed with? They weren't seen as equals. They were subordinates to the Genovese family and the Gambino family. And as we know, Tony Salerno, Paul Castellano, they were kind of subset. And ultimately, someone like Jimmy Coonan just kind of got in line. The Irish mob were their own group. They were kind of basically subcontracted out to deal with certain things. You know, and ultimately, you know, Jimmy dealt with his own crimes, you know, and was dealt with as a separate organization. I would look at them like I would look at, you know, the Chinese mob or the Albanian mob. You know, now, however, as far as were they equals and not to be messed with, I wouldn't say they were equals, but they were definitely tough. I mean, you know, you look up someone like Mickey Featherstone, people like that, they were violent individuals. But once Coonan got involved and kind of connected everything to the Gambinos and the Genoveses, they were kind of subordinates at that point. But no, they weren't on the same level as the mob. Multi-question here, says the chain. Why don't families stick with the original family name? What merits one change family name? Why doesn't it change with every new boss? Yeah, we've talked about this before, and I don't think there's a really correct answer to this. It's really just about, you know, you taking the steps to change it, I guess. Now, in the Bonanno crime family and that sort of case, Joey Messino, I think at one point maybe considered a change to the Messino crime family. I'm sure John Gotti maybe at one point wanted to change it, but I think a lot of it just has to do with staying out of the limelight. Why would you want to do that? It's almost putting a stamp on your head saying, arrest me. I think people are just fine with the way it is. They're okay with just having the boss title. I don't think we'll ever see a name change, quite honestly.
I don't think we'll see a name change at this point. I think, too, it's a question of, you know, the feelings toward the outgoing boss, right? I mean, like, if you look at the Gambino family, prior to that, it was the Anastasia family. Well, Carlo Gambino took out Albert Anastasia, so it would be odd if he kept the name, right? I mean, obviously, there was no love lost there. So I think part of it is that, and you've got these names now that are mostly of guys who are kind of legends. Like, I think you'd get a lot of pushback trying to change it.
Exactly. Scott, whatever happened to Tommy DeSimone's body, did they ever find it? No, not that I know of. From what I understand, it's been unknown. And look, like many other mob murders, I don't think we'll ever find it. Well, we won't. But no, it was never found. They led you to believe in the film that, you know, they couldn't give him an open casket. They didn't give him an open casket because they didn't have a body. Was Murray the Cameron Humphreys a made outfit member? Or was he a big player? He was not a made member. He was Welsh, so he was not going to ever be made. But was he a big player? Absolutely. Murray Humphreys was very powerful. A lot of people believe that Tom Hagen, the character in The Godfather, is inspired by Murray Humphreys. We'll do a show on Murray very soon. Probably, according to law enforcement, one of the nicest mobsters ever. He would kind of be on the same level as your Jimmy Burke, your Meyer Lansky, you know, someone like that. When we look back at non-Italian, you know, Murray Humphreys was very powerful. He was very close with Sam Giancana. He was very close with high-level outfit people. You know, he was a guy that actually grew up in Oklahoma, I believe. He ended up going to Chicago and was a fascinating guy. Al Capone had very good things to say about him. He was a very powerful guy. Was he made? No, he was not an official member, but he was just as important. There were plenty of people that weren't as powerful as Murray Humphreys. And you know, Murray did a lot of good things in the community as well. He's one of the people in the mob that I think when we look back, he was actually one of the decent people probably out there. We'll talk about Murray down the road, but yes, definitely very powerful, was a huge player. Gary Chalmers, what's happening? Chiming in from across the pond. He says, how close and for how long did Matty Madonna work with Nicky Barnes? About 15 years, you know, 10, 15 years. They actually served time in Greenhaven in the 60s, and they would actually get connected through not only Matty Madonna, but Joey Gallo, who we talked about. Joey was up at Greenhaven as well. Joey was hanging around with Nicky Barnes, and Matty Madonna actually obviously knew Joey, and they would meet each other. And once they got out of prison, they were dealing heroin together. You know, basically Matty would drop off a trunk of heroin. Barnes would pick it up. They obviously had a connection through Sicily, and yeah, they worked together for a while until Matty in the 70s went back to prison for a long bid. But yeah, there was definitely a lot of connection between, you know, the Lucchese crime family. But look, the Lucchese sold a lot of drugs. If you know anything about Joe Beck Di Palermo, some of those people, the Bonattos and Lucchese were very big in drug trafficking. And yes, Nicky Barnes and Matty were very close. If you could live the life of one wise guy, who would it be? Blackjack, do you have an answer off the top of your head? If you could, would you say Neil Delacroce?
You know, that's where I was going to go.
So you would be you would be okay with being as violent as he was?
I mean, yeah, if I'm going to be in that life, I mean, that's part of it, right? I mean, for me, the answer is either Mr. Neal or it's Carlo Gambino. Like, I mean, Carlo Gambino was the king of the volcano for a long time, did very little time, and you know, was hardly ever locked up, and you know, was a guy who was not just respected, but I think in a lot of ways loved by the people that were around him. So I guess I would probably take Carlo over Neal. I think Carlo had a hell of a run.
Yeah, I think for me, I would probably, and you know, this is kind of a crazy one, but I don't strive to be like any of these people, but you know, I think deep down, Blackjack, I'm obsessed with being kind of number one. I don't like people that tell me what to do. I want to be in control. I don't like sharing, that sort of thing. It's my way or the highway. And, you know, I've always been fascinated by the regal charm of the guy. I don't know how you don't say John Gotti.
Listen, don't get me wrong. I mean, I think that there are certainly aspects of both of our personalities that we relate to John Gotti, right? I think that's why we both like him so much. I just think that when you look at the whole picture, you know, I wouldn't want to spend the amount of time John Gotti spent in prison because it was a lot.
I think I would be either John or, and I'm sure we'll get people on Reddit because I get people occasionally on Reddit. These fucking guys, all they do is stick their mobster. We're asked the question, we're answering it. I would also say maybe Tony Ducks. You know, I always found Tony Ducks pretty interesting. I think I would more or less want to be involved more in like unions and things like that as opposed to like the low bottom end shit. But plus I talk a lot, so I'd probably been caught on wiretap a lot. And Tony was
quack quack. You should be quack quack.
Oh no, I wouldn't want to be that prick. No way. But that's actually a good question. I never really thought of it. I don't know if I'd want to be any of these people, to be quite honest. That's why I don't commit crimes, because I don't want to be, you know, go to jail. But yeah, good question. Ted, I'm from Northeast Ohio. I was wondering if you could talk about the mob around Cleveland and Youngstown, plus Danny Green in the Cleveland area being called Bomb City. Yeah, it was a weird time in Cleveland for a long time. Yeah, we'll do a Danny Green show very soon, 100%. I I actually started to get a little bit more on the YouTube channel sometimes with some of the smaller cities. I did a video recently on Seattle, some of the organized crime connections there. But, you know, guys, again, I just ask, you know, if you enjoy the show, be patient. You know, it's just a week to week thing. We've got many more episodes to do. We're not going anywhere, and we'll get to all your people for sure. And Ted, you as well. This is a good one. When was the last known mob hit? Not counting Frank Cali. Since that wasn't really a mob hit, how does the mafia still operate without the threat of violence, mob hits, and people getting whacked or thing in the past? How do they operate without this threat? Oh, it's a lot tougher. People are allowed to kind of do what they want at this point. But I will say this, and whether you believe me or not, I don't really care. The truth of the matter is there are various parts of New York City that are still very mob controlled. Certain streets, certain neighborhoods. Go to Bensoners, go to 18th Avenue. Yep. Go to some of those areas, go up to Arthur Avenue, go up to some of these spots. The mob's still around. As far as when was the last mob hit? The last mob hit would have been Michael Meldish back in 2013, which we talked about during Stephen Crea. There have been some associates. There was a guy hit recently back in 2018, Sylvester Zatola. It wasn't necessarily a mob hit. He was an associate. He was actually killed by Blood's gang members on orders from his own son. But yeah, the last big mob hit would have been Michael Meldish back in 2013. And that case is still being litigated through the appeals process. But I always consider a mob hit to be anyone in the mob. But you're right. True mob hit where mobsters kill other mobsters. It would have been Michael Meldish, who actually, quite honestly, was not a mobster because he was not Italian. He was a gangster, but either way, that was your last mob hit. This is a good one. What U.S. president would have made the best mob boss? I think there's only one answer to that.
It's Trump.
Donald J. Trump.
It's Trump.
I think there's only one answer there.
Jesus, that's the layup of all layups.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. You know, I think I don't think there's any other answer.
No, nobody else comes close.
Someone responded and said Joe Biden. I don't
see that. Oh, God.
Maybe who would be the best?
He could have been like a Chin Gigante, except I don't think he's faking it.
Yeah, true. Yeah, I think Donald Trump is the only – I mean, I actually have said before, I think Donald Trump would have – you know, if he would have – let's say in the 70s, instead of – you know, maybe he took his casinos kind of the way like they did with the outfit, like with, you know, being kind of a lefty Rosenthal type. I could have seen that. Like – Donald would have been, I think, very good in the mob.
I've said it on this show before. I think that if John Gotti did stayed out of prison, he would have been president.
You have said that.
They're the same guy.
Yeah, I think John's a little more charming, I guess.
That's why he definitely would have been president.
Yeah, I think he would have been able to do a lot. And look, if Donald could be on president, I think John could have been. But yeah, I think the only answer to this, Ben Walter, is Donald Trump, for sure. All right, Blackjack, we got one for you from Matt Williams. Why did the judge of the commission trial sentence sentence Tony Salerno, Tony Ducks, and Carmine Persico all to 100 years for RICO, but Bruno and Delicato to only 40 years for murder? Surely murder is a worse crime. Which is very true.
It's not.
We've talked about this.
Yeah, in the eyes of the federal government, it's not. Racketeering is a worse crime. It's punishable by a higher minimum than murder is. Now, murder is obviously punishable by up to life in prison, but the mandatory minimum is lower than is the minimum for RICO, which, if you think about it, is fucking insane. But that's how the federal government views these cases, because they knew that the chances of them convicting mafia members of a murder charge was much lower than them convicting them of a RICO charge. So they stack the deck in a way that ensures if we catch you on RICO, we're essentially going to put you away for life.
And remember, I mean, a lot of like the Salernos, Corallos, Perscos, I mean, remember, they had conspiracy to commit murder, things like that, sure. A lot of these guys. So, you know, all of it rolled into one. Bruno Delicato was only convicted of one murder. So he was not given RICO. It didn't go to him necessarily. Was Joe Watts as respected and influential as Jimmy Burke when it comes to Nam Event? I wouldn't put Joe Watts at the level of Jimmy Burke. I think Marlansky's on the top level. Yeah. Jimmy would be right below. I would put Joe Watts in the same category as, like, you know, Murray Humphreys, you know, someone like that. Joe Watts is very respected, though. I think,
you've got a clear 1 and 1A, and then it's everyone else.
Sure, 100%. Now, when it comes to kind of who Joe, I mean, Joe Watts is more powerful than most, you know, soldiers and made men. I mean, Joe Watts is right up there. He made a lot of money. He was given a huge undertaking when Castellano was killed. He got Blotti's Black Loan Book. You know, he was a big time hitman. He was very respected and influential, and, you know, was only not made just because of, you know, it precluded him. Today, you know, if he was coming up today, he would have been made. They wouldn't have even cared, I don't think. All right, last one, Joe Warren. How did John Stanfa escape death after the Angelo Bruno hit? A lot of people have always wondered that. I'll tell you the only reason. He was in on it, 100%. There's no way Bruno would have been killed, the 10th and Snyder, and John would have walked away if he weren't involved. He would have been killed as well. He lured Bruno. They had dinner. He lured him home. He probably told them, look, I'm going to be taking him to his house. I always drop him off right in front. You come up behind. Make sure I don't get hurt, you know, and down the road, I think John Stanfa had the thought that he would be in power at some point. He was definitely in on it. That's how he escaped death. It's that simple. Really good questions this week, guys. Really good stuff. Always enjoy doing that. Seems like all the questions flow very well. What we're going to do now is we're going to get into our biography this week. We're going to talk about Vinny Asaro. And, you know, Vinny is still around. He's in his 80s. He's had a lot of stuff going on over the last 10 or so years, which we're going to get into. He's one of those guys that really goes back to the 50s, quite honestly. I mean, he goes back to, you know, the early hijacking days. He made his way through, like most people in Ozone Park do, stealing. He was very connected at JFK Airport. We'll get into some of his connections in his family. And I urge you guys, when you listen to this biography, you included Blackjack, it's very important to pay attention, because Vinny Asaro is very much wrapped up in a web. Everyone in his family that was a male was involved in the mafia. He would groom his nephew to become a mobster, and his nephew would groom people to become mobsters. And ultimately, that's what would put him away. So we're going to talk about it all right now. Vinny Asaro on the sit down. Vincent Asaro was born in 1935 in Ozone Park, Queens. As we know, really outside of Bensoner's Brooklyn and maybe one or two other places, there's no bigger mob stronghold than Ozone Park. You know, I could tell you dozens and dozens of mobsters that were from Ozone Park. It is a mob haven, Howard Beach, that area. Blackjack, when you think of mafia, it's almost like when you think of America, you think of what, the cherry pie and baseball. When you think of Ozone Park, you think of the mafia. That simple.
100%. I mean, like you hit the three on the head, right? If you ask me mob strongholds in New York City, it's Bensonhurst, Ozone Park, Howard Beach. Like, those are the three.
Yeah. And growing up, I mean, being in the mob is in Vincent Asaro's blood. His father and grandfather were both in the mob. And his uncle was actually Michael Zaffirano, interestingly enough. And for anyone that doesn't know who Michael Zaffirano is, he was a very high end Bonanno crime family member. He was quite honestly, the king of porn. And I did a video on him on our YouTube channel. He literally owned Times Square, him and Matty the Horse Ainiello. Michael Zaffirano was a powerful, powerful guy, and would ultimately die after his business was raided. And he ran from the cops and actually passed out due to a heart attack and died on the street in the 70s. So Vinny Asaro had the mob in his blood. It was something that he lived by and would always live by. He would actually, as a teenager and in his early 20s in the 50s, actually got addicted to heroin. He became an addict. He was doing heroin regularly. And he actually, according to him, would quit cold turkey at one point in the 70s. He just decided he wasn't going to do it anymore. But he had a bad heroin problem. And ultimately, you know, they say, you know, addicts, you end up just becoming addicted to something else. He would actually become, I think it was pretty clear towards the end of his life and probably today, one of his main problems that he would deal with is a gambling addiction. And I think really his family would say that he gave up heroin just to give get another addiction. And look, if you know anything about the mob, there were plenty of people that were big time gamblers. Vinny Asaro would be inducted into the Bonanno crime family by the mid 70s, 1977, but he was already making a name for himself in the 60s. He was a hijacker. He was someone that knew how to steal and knew how to steal well. He was involved with swag, stealing stuff, cigarette hijacking, all sorts of different things. And he knew how to make money. And he started quickly to meet the right people. He would actually get acquainted with Jimmy Burke, who we know well, as opposed, we did an episode on him, the Goodfellas. He and Jimmy Burke were stealing stuff. They were running out of Lufthansa and some of the other air terminals at JFK. And if you know anything, we talked about the Bonanno family. They were always very connected in the hijacking game, whether it was Joey Messina or some of the other groups. Obviously, the Lucchese family with Paul Verri had a hijacking crew. And then John Gotti actually started as a hijacker. So, well, actually, most high-end mobsters actually started in cargo hijacking.
Yeah, and I think that makes sense to some degree, right, Jeff? Because, you know, if you think about it, that presented a great opportunity to earn. I mean, these guys weren't out there running numbers. They were out there, you know, looking for big scores. And a lot of times during that time period, they were able to find them, whether it was cigarettes or jewelry or whatever they were boosting from the airport. It gave you an opportunity to really earn a lot of money and separate yourself.
Yeah, and by the late 60s, they were stealing a lot of cargo, a lot of swag, and obviously you need fencers to sell the swag. And Jimmy Burke and Vincent Asaro was alleged they would meet an individual called Paul Katz. Paul Katz was a warehouse owner that was moving stolen merchandise for Asaro and for Jimmy Burke. On December 6, 1969, Paul Katz's family would report him missing and he would disappear. And we'll get into what would ultimately happen and why Vinny Asaro was connected to the death of Paul Katz. But Vinny's making his way into the 60s, into the 70s as a capable earner, someone that has the mob in his blood. As I said, in 1977, he would be inducted alongside Gerard Jerry Chili, a Bonanno capo, and Peter Monteleone into the Bonanno crime family. It wouldn't take long till he became a capo regime. We'll talk about that in a second, but obviously, in November of, or in 1978, we would obviously know what happens, the Lufthansa heist. And we've talked about this before, but what connects Vinny Asaro to, for most people, is he ran that arm of JFK that belonged to the Bonanno crime family. It was discussed many times that when they were at Robert's Lounge and they were putting this heist together, Vinny Asaro was someone that would benefit from this. He was one of the guys involved directly. He was not involved with the actual heist, but the feds would allege that he was involved. Now, ultimately down the road, he would be forgiven of all this. And they said he didn't do it. He was found not guilty. And there's also reason to believe, according to certain authors, that he was not involved. But wiretap conversations are proof. He knew a lot about it. He would talk a lot about Jimmy Burke never shared any of the spoils of the robbery with us. And, you know, he would talk about they had collaborated at one point. And it was clear that to move stuff to Lufthansa Air Terminal, that belonged to the Bonanno crime family. And you were going to have to obviously involve Vinny Asaro with that. As we know, in that robbery, there would be millions of dollars worth of money and jewelry stolen. And interestingly enough, a few weeks after the robbery, Vinny Asaro was actually seen blowing hordes and hordes of money. And he actually gave Joey Messina jewelry on behalf of the family as a kick-up. So it's led to believe that although he was found not guilty in the Lufthansa connection, he probably had something to do with it and probably was involved.
It would be hard to believe that he didn't have some involvement, Jeff, just because, as you mentioned, he oversaw the Bonanno family's interests in JFK Airport. So this doesn't happen without him at least knowing about it. So whether he was an active participant is up for debate, you know, based on the verdict of the jury in 2015. But the reality is, I think you can agree, this does not happen without him knowing.
Yeah, and he got, I think, some sort of peace from this. Once this is all taken care of, he would magically become capo regime in 1979, just 1 year after Lufthansa. I have to feel like maybe that had something to do with it as well. But he was a rising star in the Bonanno crime family. I mean, this is a family that Now, obviously, he's had a lot of trouble over the years. We know about Carmen Galanti. We know about the three capos. We know about all that stuff. But, Vinny Asaro was a shining light, at least for the Bonanno family at this point. He would continue to steal throughout the 80s. He would continue to set up other rackets as well, including porn. He had a huge loan sharking business. He continued to steal. He would actually operate a business, most of his business, out of an auto body shop in Ozone Park. And that building would be owned by his cousin, Gaspare Valenti, who would actually be one of his main subordinates in the family. Vinny was said to enjoy gambling, and he said, you know, he loved going to the horse track. He loved blowing money. And at one point, Valenti, who would end up cooperating many years later, he would talk about he would see Vinny Asaro blow $15,000, no problem, at the track. It was almost like he would get money and go out the other hand within minutes of getting it. He also, at the auto body shop, it was said that he enjoyed animals, blackjack. And there's an interesting story that would arise about Vincent Asaro in and around the time of the 70s. He was operating this, business out of this auto body shop. And an individual was doing business with the family, a Gambino associate called Peter Zaccaro. He was doing some business with them and that sort of thing. He had to go see Vinny Asaro at the junk shop one day. And Vinny had a dog there. He owned this dog, and he would let it run around the auto body shop. And I guess he was a little bit of a mangy mutt or whatever. And I guess at one point the dog attempted to bite Peter Zaccaro, and he shot the dog.
Whoa.
And shortly after Zaccaro killed the dog, Vinny Asaro would go to Zaccaro's house and, quote, according to Gangland News, chastise Zaccaro for killing the dog and threatened to kill him for it. Now, accompanying him on the visit were said to be Tommy DeSimone and Stax Edwards, who were collaborators of Jimmy Burke, as we know. He would then, Vinny Asaro, ask for a sit down with Joe Mussino and asked Mussino, could we kill Zaccaro for killing his dog? Mussino would ultimately deny it and say that it wasn't worth a human life and ruled in favor of Zaccaro, the prosecutors would mention. So Vinny Asaro was a gangster, but he loved animals, Blackjack, and he was willing to kill another man due to him killing his dog.
I mean, listen, people have strong ties to their dogs, Jeff. Don't fuck with a man's dog. And I mean, it's crazy. The dog, makes a move on you and you just shoot him. Crazy to shoot another guy's dog. That's nuts. But, ultimately, I think Zaccaro was he was lucky that he got off the way he did.
Yeah, he really was. Obviously, I don't know a ton about the dog itself, but I mean, it did try to bite people. But yes, to just shoot the dog, I mean, maybe kick it or something like that. As I said, throughout his 80s, people would discuss that Vinny Asaro would become famous for living on the edge. He would blow tons of money, and he just really seemed like he was going at it a wrong way, but he was making money. He would continue to stay pretty quiet, though. He would obviously run a crew, and he became a huge loan shark, started to make a lot of money through that business. He had a nice home. He was living comfortably. But as the 80s and 90s play themselves out, things start to go down. And I kind of want to talk about, I want to go back to that Paul Katz stuff. Yep. Which we'll talk about in a second. But what Vinny Asaro was also known to do was he was always grooming the next in line. And his nephew was coming up in the game, a kid called Ronnie Gialonzo. Gialonzo was his close nephew. It was clear that he was going to go into that business, and he would start running around town, kind of doing all sorts of crazy shit, became a loan shark, started funding protection money from drug addicts or drug dealers. He was doing a lot of work, and Vinny was starting to collaborate with some of these younger guys. And he always wanted to keep Cosa Nostra living, it seemed like, Blackjack. He was always kind of looking ahead, but he was making money. Things were going on. He was, beating the rap. He was never ultimately taken in, according to him. He didn't think he'd ever be taken in for some of this stuff, but he was living the way mobsters should live. And he was a very capable guy for the Bonannos in that family.
For sure. And I think that that's part of, the guys who have sort of an old school mentality to a certain degree, I think they view it as part of their responsibility is to ensure the survival of the family. And the way to do that is to make sure that the next generation is just as strong as the ones that were prior. So I think that kind of explains Vinny Asaro's, you know, thought process on it.
Now, there was a lot of quiet years for Vinny Asaro, really in the 90s, even in the early 2000s. But once the 2000s kind of got here, he was starting, as I said, kind of groom the next in line. You know, he would get his nephew kind of involved in the family. He would ultimately become a cop of regime. He had a big loan sharking book. We'll talk about kind of some of his behavior. But by the mid to late 2000s, things are starting to come undone for Vinny Asaro. And like a lot of people in the late 2000s, after kind of the Joe Mussino stuff and all that sort of thing, you know, people were living kind of hand to mouth. They were struggling, particularly Vinny Asaro. By 2008, 2009, there were people in and under Vinny Asaro that were starting to have problems, particularly his cousin, Gaspare Valenti. He would basically at some point kind of realize that for the last 30 years, he had no money. He was broke. And he basically said that he ran out of cash in 2010 and was, quote, sick of the mob life. He then, according to him, quote, called the FBI and said, I need help financially to support my family. I was tired of that life. I was having nightmares about things. So basically, he goes and says, I can get Vinny Asaro on tape. I don't want to be in this life anymore. And instead of sticking it out and being the gangster that he was, he decides he's not under indictment or anything. He just says, I don't want to be a gangster anymore. I want to cooperate against my cousin. I'm going to start wiretapping him. So in the meantime, the feds start paying his expenses, his rent, bills, all sorts of things. And he starts anytime he's with Asaro taping him. And there were some pretty interesting things that Vinny Asaro would say on tape. Now, a lot of them were nondescript. He would talk about certain times that, you know, quote, all the time you're with me, I never got you pinched, Asaro would tell Valenti at a diner. He would also discuss just like random things. He would also talk about the Lufthansa heist. Quote, I don't usually come out early no more. I don't usually come out on top. I know nothing ever happened due to that. He would also though talk about just like random things. Like he got a beautiful, nice striped bass last night at a restaurant. He would talk about he didn't pay his dues at a social club he used to hang out with. He would say, people in there hate me because I don't pay my dues. He would also discuss that things are so bad financially, Vinny Asaro, that he would have to hawk his own jewelry. Quote, nobody's earning, he said. He would also try to shake down a relative for a $3,000 share of a house of a deceased family member that had just been sold. And it was also clear that he was starting to just do business with people that he probably shouldn't do business with. Some of these younger guys, his nephew, people like that. He was kind of struggling. And I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that he had a major gambling problem. But, you know, by this point, Blackjack, this is where the mob started to really struggle. People like Vinny Asaro, there just wasn't a lot of ways to earn in the 2010s.
There wasn't, and it's also worth noting, we were in the midst of a massive recession as a country, which, I mean, trickles down to everybody, including organized crime, because people just don't have as much income. So there's less to skim from. There's less to take off the top when there's just less to go around. So, I mean, 2008, 9, 10, we were in the midst of a really bad recession in this country. And yeah, as far as their conversations go, it's the conversations of two old men, right? It's two old men who have known each other forever, just talking with each other. And, you know, as far as Gaspar Valenti goes, he's, in my mind, the worst kind of rat that there is, because as you mentioned, not only was he not under indictment or facing any jail time, but he flips on his own relative. I mean, he flips on his own cousin. I mean, it doesn't get a lot worse than that.
Exactly. By 2014, the feds felt like they had enough. They wanted to work back on Vinny Asaro, really back to the 60s and 70s. They wanted to bring him in on that Paul Katz stuff. They wanted to get him on Lufthansa. They felt like they had enough. And the feds would, in 2014, January 2014, they would indict Vinny Asaro on the Lufthansa heist, on Paul Katz, on all that stuff. And they would contend that, so Paul Katz goes missing in 1969. They would allege that Vinny Asaro and Jimmy Burke would choke him to death with a dog chain after they assumed that he was a informant. They would then bury him in the basement of a home, and that would be that. However, at one point in the 80s, Burke and Asaro decide that we're kind of worried, all sorts of things. They move the body to the home of Jimmy Burke at one point. They bury him in that home. Burke was paranoid and stuff, so he moved the body. When Valenti decides to flip, he takes the FBI to that home in 2013, and some of Katz's remains were actually still there. So this would be kind of the big talking point. They wanted to put Vincent Asaro away. Now, whether it was the wiretaps just didn't lead to anything, they didn't believe Gaspari Valenti, nobody really knows. But Vinny Asaro would actually beat the rap on this case. And this was a big news story, obviously.
Yep.
CNN covered it, all these big stations covered it. They would assert that they just didn't have enough. Maybe they didn't find Valenti to be believable. In fact, the son of Valenti, Fat Sammy Valenti, who actually was a Asaro loyalist, would actually go to court in support of not his own father, but Asaro. Gaspar Valenti was obviously ostracized for becoming an informant, but he was not a good informant because he ultimately was not believable. And they felt like some of the things said on tape were not exactly blackjack reasons for a conviction.
Yeah, I think there's three factors that go into his acquittal, Jeff. The first one is, and the most important one, is that Gaspar Valenti was not a reliable witness. The government's entire case hinged on Valenti. Everything they got was from Valenti. The wiretaps were from Valenti. The information about the body was from Valenti. Everything was from Valenti. So if you as a juror can't believe Valenti, then the rest of the case becomes very, very flimsy, right? And Valenti was caught changing his story with different versions of things multiple times during that trial. He was not a reliable witness. The second thing was the wiretaps. The wiretaps may have shown knowledge of things, but it didn't show that he was an active participant. At no point in the wiretaps does he say, I did X, or I told X to do Y. He's talking about things that he has knowledge of, which, okay, so he has knowledge of it. So what? Happened 40 years ago. And that leads to the third factor, which is, and we saw this in the government's last trial against Junior Gotti, I think there's just a fatigue to this from the general public. I think the general public looks at an old man sitting on trial for something that happened 40 years ago, and you come in with this witness who's not believable. You've got flimsy evidence. And I think most people are just like, enough already. Like, we've had it. The mob isn't running New York anymore like they were in the 80s or the 70s. I think people are just tired of it.
Yeah. And, you know, look, he would also discuss, he was caught on tape at certain points discussing that he never ended up getting any of the money from Jimmy Burke and all that sort of thing. But, you know, I don't know if there was any sort of evidence that linked him to actually killing Paul Katz.
Nothing other than Valenti. Valenti was it. And Valenti was a terrible witness.
Right. And that's the problem with a lot of these cases. And that's why a lot of these people end up going free. Because, you know, most of these people, there's really no credit check to these witnesses. You just kind of say, well, I don't feel like.
And as a defense attorney, Jeff, it's the easiest thing to discredit, right? I mean, you lay with pigs, you wake up in shit. I mean, that's what you're doing here. You're taking the word of a criminal who was in dire financial straits and saying, believe him when he's got every motive in the world to lie.
Right. The problem for Vinny Asaro, though, was he wasn't completely unscathed. During all the stuff where he was being taped, in April 2012, Vincent Asaro was desperate to earn. And he was starting to do business with some really unsavory people, particularly people like Gene Borello, quite honestly. Vincent Asaro had a beef with, it was very random, too. He was driving one day in Howard Beach. A citizen, another driver, switched lanes and basically cut him off. Asaro proceeds to chase the guy, but the driver gets away. Asaro would contact Gene Borello, and basically tell him to come see him. Gene goes and sees him, and Osaro instructs him to, here's the home address of this guy, go beat him up, go light his car on fire or something. So Gene Borello wants to earn. He's trying to show Vinny that he can do things. He would get friends of his to go with him, including, interestingly enough, John J. Gotti. Now, John J. Gotti is the grandson of John Sr. He would be Peter Gotti's son. So if John is a son, Peter, this is his grandson, John Joseph Gotti. And another individual, Matthew Rowland. They would all go find this individual and light his car on fire. They proceed to find the car. But before that, they stop and get gas at a service station. And they start pouring it on the car. They ignite it. The problem was, as they're doing this, an NYPD officer in an unmarked car sees them and pursues them. Borello gets away, but eventually Gotti's found. But the thing was carried out. They dealt with it nonetheless. They also were doing other pieces of work. According to the feds, on April 18, 2012, Gotti, Michael Jadish, Rowland, and Gene Borello would rob Maspeth Federal Savings and Loan Association. Giudice would enter the bank and hand the teller a note saying, quote, I have a bomb demanding money and other things. The teller would hand over $5,500. And they would get in the getaway car and leave. There was other pieces of work that was being done. Obviously, Ronnie G. Alonzo was doing things. Gene Borello was doing things. But in March of 2017, Vincent Asaro would be indicted again, this time for the attempted arson of the citizen's car and the Howard Beach robberies and some of the other things that were going on. So Blackjack, Vinny Asaro, by this point, the longtime gangster that he is so desperate to earn that he started to do business with individuals that have no morals, no ethics, people like Gene Borello who are committing home invasions. They're beating up people. They're hurting people. And these are the people that Vinny Asaro decided that he was ready to do business with.
Yeah, I mean, as you said, he was obviously desperate to earn because he's getting involved with people that are just doing dumb shit. I mean, there's no other way to put it. You and I both know, Jeff, in this day and age, you get away with robbing a bank, okay? It's one of the dumbest things you can do in modern times is try to rob a bank. And what are you getting away with? $5,500? Like, that's what this is worth? $5,500? By the time you split it up and kick up what you need to, what are you walking out with? $1,500? Like, what is the gain there as opposed to the risk? See, he was dealing with reckless people, and ultimately – it led to him being indicted again.
Right. And also included in that indictment in 2017 was his nephew, Ronald Ronnie G. G. Alonzo. Ronnie G., by this point, Blackjack, had a multi-million dollar gambling loan shark and an extortion ring and was said to be a Bonanno Coppa himself. Blackjack, I want you to do me a favor as we listen and do this show. Do me a favor, go to Google right now, type in Ronnie G., Howard Beach home. Take a look at Ronnie G's home. He would build that from scratch. And tell me he wasn't asking the feds to just arrest him. Have you seen that home? Look at this.
Christ.
Yeah, that's Ronnie G's
home. It's an entire block.
Right, basically. And, you know, this was the problem. This was a huge indictment. And the feds wanted Ronnie G and they wanted Vinny Asaro. And they needed a witness. And the chief witness was none other than Gene Borello. He would be the chief witness in this case. Also indicted were John J. Gotti. He would actually get a long prison sentence for that arson. He would also have to serve a state case as well. He's currently in prison. Ronnie G. got 14 years. He's, I believe, in Raybrook. And when it comes to Vincent Asaro, he would actually be found guilty as well. He would get an 8-year sentence in December of 2017. However, due to the coronavirus pandemic and his old age, in April of 2020, he would actually be granted a compassionate release. He would have a stroke in 2019, and the feds just decided, you know, this guy's in his mid-80s. We're going to let him out. But Vinny Asaro is still alive. It's unknown what he's up to now. I would have to imagine he's just living out the rest of his life in anonymity. He was actually someone that when he was actually found not guilty in the Lufthansa case, he was actually someone that went and talked to the media. He's a pretty interesting guy. I say he just wants to spend time with his family, but he was still up to the same old tricks. And everyone in this case, in that 2017 case, was found guilty, and they're all doing long prison sentences. But this is really a case for me of Vinny Asaro, kind of a sad ending to his life. He couldn't earn. He was willing to do what he had to do to earn. Sometimes when you lay down with trash, you end up becoming trash yourself. Vinny Asaro was a bad guy. He got along probably, I think, pretty unscathed, though. He never ended up going to jail, I think, for some of the real crimes that he was involved in. But, you know, kind of a wild ending to his life, Blackjack.
For sure. I mean, you know, to be sentenced to 8 years in prison, and, you know, even though he served only about 2.5 of it, you know, that's still at his age is not something you want to be doing, you know, and even having to fight the case in 2015. I mean, that's not something at your age that you really want to be screwing around with. But, you know, that's, as you mentioned, he got desperate and he got reckless, and it led to, you know, the house of cards kind of falling down around him. I mean, luckily for him, you know, he didn't die in prison. He was able to get out and have a little more time with his family and his loved ones. But, you know, what kind of a life does he really have? You've got to ask yourself that. If he was having a hard time earning before, what's he got now?
Yeah, according to Gene Borello, whether, you know, you believe what he says, I do believe this one thing that he said about Vincent Asaro. According to Gene, Vinny was a gangster's gangster. And I wouldn't disagree. I mean, Vinny Asaro literally was born into this, that world. His family was very connected, and this was the life that he lived. I've seen some incredible surveillance photos of Vinny Asaro, really during the heyday of the 80s in the mob. He was a very high-end guy. He was doing a lot of things, and, you know, it's kind of sad how his life ended. He was never willing to kind of walk away, and he ended up doing a couple of years in prison in his 80s due to his obsessions with, you know, always having to send a message to people. You know, remember, that arson case, Blackjack, was because someone cut him off in traffic.
Stupid. I mean, it's plain stupid. People get cut off in traffic every day. You don't go and set their car on fire.
Right. And that was kind of the issue with Vincent Asaro. He was a hothead. He was a guy that had a lot of things that went on, but he was a long-term gangster, and he was always going to be a gangster. It's sad that in the end, someone like Gene Borello did him in. And now look at Gene. Look what he's up to now. He's making Instagram pages, or allegedly making Instagram pages about you know, the daughters of a mobster. It's kind of a wild situation. But, you know, Gene would even talk about Blackjack. He was schooling the young Gotti, a kid. You know, it's kind of like a house of cards. You know, Vinny Asaro's the guy, and then he's schooling Ronnie G, and Ronnie G's schooling Gene, and Gene's schooling this junior Gotti kid. So, I mean, the mob wheels always turn, but these are the kind of people being, you know, involved now. People like Gene Borello, people like, you know, this Gotti grandson. I mean, this Gotti grandson, he should just be, you know, go do something else in your life. Haven't your family been through enough pain?
Yeah, it hasn't ended well for anyone with the name Gotti, you know, except for Junior, you know, who managed to pull himself out of this. So I don't really know what John J. Gotti is thinking here.
Right. You know, he'll have to do a couple more years in prison. Hopefully he's able to get out and, you know, live a different life, because, you know, the mob that his family was involved in many years ago is not the same one now. But
it doesn't exist anymore. Not that group.
Right. An interesting story, nonetheless. That's the show for this week. Vinny Asaro, who, you know, ultimately never was really convicted of his crimes per se. But that's what happens when you take the words of people like Valenti, who no one believed. All right, Blackjack, as always, thanks as always for coming on. And thanks, everybody, for listening. We appreciate it. If you enjoy the show, make sure you give us 5 stars. Give us a review on iTunes, Spotify, wherever you're listening. Go check us out on YouTube. You can find the Sit Down there. Just type in the Sit Down, a Mafia History Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at the Sit Down 7. We appreciate your involvement in the show. And we'll be back next week with another great episode of the Sit Down. We'll see you then. Have a good night.